All right, afternoon, everyone. I'm looking forward to this. I'm very, very looking forward to this session. The stuff I'm going to be talking about are things that I've been working through and thinking through and wondering in the last probably 2 or 3 years. And I'm excited about what God can show us as we're thinking through this and as we are working through this concept that I want to talk about. I named this session Strategic Church. And what I want to have is I want to have each of us thinking through what does it mean to have a successful church? And what do we do as the youth here in 2021 as we're looking forward to the church that will be tomorrow's church and the role that we're playing in the church now? What is church and how can we fill that role that we have in it? In the last couple of years, I think we've all been noticing more and more, and we've been thinking, hearing, talking about what has been referred to as the new Marxism. I'm not going to comment so much on what I think about the idea of Marxism, but suffice it to say, it's something that I think scares a lot of us as Christians with a bit of history of the world. We know what Marxism has done throughout the world, the effects of communism, which was inspired by Marxism. And I think a lot of us are looking forward to the next 100 years and wondering, what is America going to be like? What's the world going to be like? And we're wondering, how do we be the church in the next years? How do we combat this threat of a totalitarian, potentially authoritarian system of you must think according to the party line? And we've been noticing that trickling down from the universities into kind of every area of life, the way we look at gender, the way we look at racism, and some of these real issues in society have been kind of perverted with a very specific Marxist tint in many universities. And so we're all wondering, how do we be church with that? What I want to do is I want to turn to the example of someone who actually lived in a Marxist society. And he asked the question, how do we be strategic? How do we effectively live out church in a time period when everything that we Christians stand for is despised and rejected and you're not allowed to be a Christian? That's what Pastor Kolakowicz lived in. Kolakowicz lived in a country called Czechoslovakia, originally grew up in Croatia. And Kolakowicz was a pastor in this place, and he was effectively anti-Nazi. He talked about the dangers of fascism, and he lived in a country that was taken over by the Nazis, and Nazi Germany was perhaps the biggest threat at that time in Eastern Europe. He fled his home country of Croatia and went to Czechoslovakia, ultimately. And he began seeing the Nazi forces being turned back as Soviet Russia came from the east, slowly pushed Nazi Germany and their armies back to Berlin. So he was watching the Red Army invade country after country, and he was a student of history, and he knew what the result of the Soviet thought, Marxist thought, and what it had done to Stalin, and what it would do to the rest of Europe. And he said, look, if we don't do something about the church under an authoritarian regime that says you must toe the party line, you must agree with the state or else, is just going to fold. And so Kolakowicz went to Czechoslovakia, and Czechoslovakia, just for a bit of history, was a country that combined two ethnic groups. It was the Czechs and the Slovaks. They didn't agree on a lot of things. They were very different, but they were held together in an uneasy alliance. And right in the middle of World War II and the years following, there was this uneasy tension. Ultimately, it split into two states, the Czech Republic and Slovakia. But right now, this is Czechoslovakia. So Kolakowicz comes into this country and says, what they're promising, because Soviet Russia was promising, look, help us to oust the Nazis, and we'll give you back your country free. You'll be able to live. You'll be able to do whatever you want. In a free country with your own state authority. And Kolakowicz said, I know what Marxist thought has done throughout the world. Stalin is not going to give you a free country. What he's going to do is he's going to get his armies inside your country. He's going to take over, and that will be the end of freedom for you all. So he said, Czechoslovakia will be a Soviet bloc state, and you need to prepare now. People actually listened to him. Amazingly, he was somebody from out of the country, almost no relationships within the state. He came, and he began explaining this, and people listened to him, and they said, Kolakovich, what do we do? We want to prepare. He took the example of a Belgian priest who, years before, had established little cells of resistance within his own, within countries there in Eastern Europe. And he began organizing these little groups of people who would come together, they would study theology, they would pray together, they would ask God's Spirit to speak to them in this. And this is within an Eastern Orthodox and Catholic setting. Basically, they were rediscovering the gospel. So Kolakovich took that strategy and said, this is what we need to do in our own country. If the church is going to remain and if the church is going to go on, we have to rediscover fellowship. We have to rediscover our beliefs. We have to become deeply rooted in what it means to be a Christian. And just thinking about that verse that Tim chose as something of a theme verse from Acts, where it says, the disciples went ahead in the apostles' doctrine and in fellowship, breaking of bread, and a fourth one, and prayer. That to me is a beautiful encapsulation of what Christianity is. It's strong thinking. It's the apostles' doctrine. It's taking seriously what God has said and what God has done. And then it's close fellowship. It's discovering church not as like a thing you do, but something you are. And these small groups became not just places to think in a cold, dead way of we just need to like read lots of books and use bigger words, but it was a sort of thinking where it was, we need to rediscover what it means to be a Christian and then live it together in communion with the church. And so Kolakovich redefined what church was. In Czechoslovakia, he had a couple of years before the Soviet army came across the border and took everything over, and just as he had promised, they took over the country and refused to give it back for years and years. Kolakovich's church became extremely persecuted, but the work he had done ahead of time in preparing the church and in saying, we need to think strategically or we're not going to make it. And through the work of the Spirit within that church, the Slovak church in Czechoslovakia was one of the strongest in Eastern Europe and withstood years and years of persecution from the state, with the state telling him, you have to believe what we say. And the Slovak church said, no, no, we believe in the Bible. We are Christians. And they lived out Christianity right there. And so that is something of a model for me, a beautiful model of Christians saying, we live in a time period that's unique to any other, and every time period is, and we need to think, what does the church look like in the broadest sense? What is the church? And then in the narrow sense, what is church for us right now? And so the mission of the church really is to spread the gospel and to live out the glory of God before the world. And so we need to always ask the question, how are we doing on what the church is? How are we spreading the gospel, and how are we living out the glory of God within the church? And that is strategy. Before we go any further, I think a lot of people look at strategy with a bit of skepticism. And I think in a sense it's good skepticism, but it's not helpful. So let me explain what I mean. The skepticism of strategy basically comes from a couple of sources. One of them is people might think if you are strategic, you have a sort of pride that just says, I have it all in myself, I don't need God, I just need to like come up with a good plan. And I think we all know a good plan without God is disaster. And so what I don't want us to come away with from this talk on strategic church is you need to come up with a strategy or a plan of how to do church in some sense outside of God. But in the Christian sense, everything under God, the entire story of being a Christian is everything to the glory of God. And so it's this idea of the Spirit and thinking together. It's the idea of God working through the church and us making plans, both together, or we can't leave out either. And so But I think we need to ask the question, okay, so what was Jesus? Was Jesus strategic? Was Paul strategic? Was the early church strategic? Did they just have sort of a model of the way you need to do church at all times, and they stuck with it, and that's why they were so successful? Or did they ask the question, what do we need to change to be more strategic? What does a good plan look like as they prayed and as they walked in the Spirit? So I want to start with Jesus. What did Jesus do? Jesus founded the church. Right from the beginning, in a unique model, he sent out the disciples two by two, and he said, don't take any notebooks with you, don't take shoes, don't take extra money. Just go find a village and find the people who are people of peace. Go hang out with them, preach the gospel, tell them that the kingdom of God has come, heal the sick, etc. And he gave them actually an interesting set of instructions that was strategy. He gave them something that kept them from getting off track. And so I want to look at that as strategy. A plan that says, look, we need to be the church. We need to stay on track with the goals of we are here to evangelize, to disciple, to lead the church. And how do we do that? Matthew 18 and Matthew 16, which Rick alluded to, talked a little bit about, he gives the disciples a roadmap for how to navigate interpersonal relationships. What happens when you have sin within the church? And Jesus says, call them, like, go to this person yourself, go talk to them, and if they don't listen, gather more around and talk about this. And ultimately, you want to get the person, you want to work with them, you want to give them the chance to be redeemed. And that was another strategy. What do interpersonal relationships look like within the church? One more example from Jesus. He told his disciples, start evangelizing in Jerusalem, and then go to Judea, go to Samaria, go to the ends of the earth. That was a unique plan. He could have done it any other set of ways. He could have said, start in the end zone and work back so that you can make sure you get everybody, or whatever. But he chose to give them a specific strategy. Start in Jerusalem. Preach the gospel right where you are. Go to Judea, etc., to the ends of the earth. That is strategy. Now, you might say, okay, Jesus was God, so that's a little different. We're the church, so don't we just take what God has already given us and run with it? My answer to that is the Apostle Paul. Because the Apostle Paul was not God, and he had a lot of strategy. Let me read a passage here from 1 Corinthians 2. This is Paul saying, this was my strategy when he went to the church in Corinth. And so it was with me, brothers and sisters. When I came to you, I didn't come with eloquence or human wisdom as I proclaimed to you the testimony about God. For I resolved to know nothing while I was with you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. I came to you in weakness with great fear and trembling. My message and my preaching were not with wise and persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power so that your faith might not rest on human wisdom, but on God's power. So he said, look, I'm not going to talk about my philosophy while I'm with you. I'm not going to go into, proofs for God's existence or why evolution is false or whatever. I'm just going to talk to you about Jesus and him crucified. Now, Paul in Athens actually had a different strategy. When Paul was in Athens, he started with creation. And he began explaining from the beginning the foundation of Christianity, starting with the creation of the earth. So Paul had a different strategy in Athens than the one he used in Corinth. Here he said, I started with Jesus and I didn't want to preach about anything else so that your faith wouldn't rest in human wisdom but on God's power. All right, one more example from Paul. Paul refused to accept payment for the gospel in certain places. He kind of jokes with them about it at one point. He says, I robbed other churches so that I could make sure I helped you. Other churches were supporting him, and he, in fact, worked himself. He worked himself so that he didn't have to receive any sort of payment in order to survive. And he says he did this so that they wouldn't think, Paul, you're doing this just for the money. You're preaching the gospel just because you want to get money from us. So this was Paul's strategy. So now I want to talk about, what is the need? Why do we need a strategy in this particular time? So we believe that strategy is important, that Jesus and Paul used strategy in their witness through the Holy Spirit, and yet we need to ask ourselves not just what was the strategy in the past, not just what other people have used, but what is the strategy for the church in 2021 and beyond, and what does it mean for us? So we need to start with what the vision of church is, and then ask ourselves what's wrong. And then we need to get back to the model. So I want to give like a little thought here, which is the way I look at strategy within the church. We are people uniquely of the book, the Bible. And so when we have a problem, we're not people who are just out on our own trying to discover life on our own. We're people who go back to the owner's manual and we say, what is humanity supposed to be? What are we supposed to be like? And we have somewhere to start. I really enjoy listening to lectures by certain philosophers today. I find it very fascinating. One of the things I always find sad and something that always surprises me in a sense, although it shouldn't, is how much secular philosophers often say things like, I just don't really know what to do with this. When it comes to how to fix the world in this sense, we just don't have answers. We're groping, we're grasping for a solution to this problem, whatever it is. And in the other sense, we're all human. So we all have those things where we run into, and it's like, even us Christians, we say ourselves, we're all finite, and we don't have all the answers. But we do have the answer, and that's the difference. So Christians go back to the roadmap when they're trying to discover, who are we? How do we get back to the truth? I'm going to divide this into two categories. When we're talking about need within the church, what is the church? Because the effective roadmap is we want to have the apostles' doctrine and the breaking of bread and the prayers together and the fellowship. That's the model of church. So when we're looking at what's wrong, it's always going to come back to one of two things, fellowship or thinking. Now, fellowship, I don't just mean church when I say that, like a fellowship. When I say fellowship, I mean the organic, like coming together to talk about things and coming together to know you as an individual and for you to know me as an individual and for us to pray for each other and be there for each other in every way possible. That is fellowship. It's not just like I go to a place where Christians get together. That's fellowship. When I say thinking, I don't mean thicker books necessarily. I mean, we need to think through life in the sense that we go back to what is true and we highly guard the truth, which is the Word of God, so that whenever something goes wrong, we can always say, no, that's the truth. This is what the Bible says. This is what true philosophy, true thinking, true theology is. And so thinking should never be something cold and dead where it's like, where people joke about intellectuals, which sometimes unfortunately is true, of intellectuals just kind of have their heads in the sky and can't do anything right except for thinking. Which, as I said, sometimes is true. But thinking is supposed to be not just something in your head. It's supposed to be something that connects to all of life. And so the connection between here's what I think about life and here's how I live my life, and Christians should uniquely be very, very close. And so the resurrection shouldn't just be a neat thought that we think about every Easter. It should be something that's like right at the tip of our tongues when somebody says, so why do you do what you do? We say, it's because of the resurrection. I'm okay with suffering. I'm okay with going through hardship because the resurrection shows that we are headed as Christians for new life forever and ever. And so any sort of hardship between now and then is insignificant compared to the sort of glory that's going to follow. That's Christian thinking. That's the way Paul talked about suffering. He says, everything I go to is nothing compared to the glory that should follow. And he talks about the resurrection as being the point in which everything changed, the unique hope. So, two areas, fellowship and thinking. And none of them are cold and dead. They're supposed to be together. Fellowship as something organic and something personal, and thinking as something that's deeply connected to our actions. So it's not just theoretical, but it's practical. I want to talk about each of those categories then as issues. unsuccessful discipleship. Unsuccessful discipleship is when the church tries to be on mission in the world and fails. It's what happens when the church wants to reach out to others, but nobody's coming into the church. I heard a poll last week, I believe, that said that 60% of Americans identify 60% of Americans identify as something other than Christian, which actually kind of shocked me. I thought it might be something like 60% the other way, 70%, something like that. For most of the 20th century, almost everyone in America identified as Christian in some sense. And we might talk about it like we want to spread true Christianity. Not all these people are Christians, and I get that. But there is the sense at least that we're living in a Christian society and the people around us are more or less God-fearing, that when we're talking to our neighbor or relating to somebody on the street or going to the store or whatever, we're basically in a Christian society where everyone thinks about the same way, that you should be a good person and you should, in the sense that, you know, there's a God and so God will ultimately, you're ultimately going to go to judgment someday, so you need to do what's right. That is no longer the case. And so that's a fact that we should look squarely at. It's not something to avoid, because that is the reality of the millennium that we're in, and that's the reality of America right now. So if we're going to reach out in a society that's distinctly non-Christian in more and more ways, and in some ways anti-Christian, we need to change the way we look at discipleship. Now, there's a response to that that looks like, let's figure out all the things that they like, they being everyone who's not Christian, and let's try to craft church sort of after everything that other people outside the church like. So let's make sure we get our pink carpet and our coffee and our whatever else that supposedly non-Christians like, and let's make sure our worship music is just right. And hopefully then everyone's going to want to come in the church and we're going to be successful at evangelism. That has failed so dreadfully in America. And I hope we accept that, and I think we do. So we still need to be strategic, but strategy can't look like that because that's a failed strategy. And it's failed because we were giving up our beliefs in some way. The belief that it's really all about Jesus. It's not about the things that we give people. But church is the fact that God is there, and the fact that the church is different is because God is with us, not the fact that we have extraordinary pink carpet. And so we need to understand, what is it then? If we're being unsuccessful at discipleship, and it's something I think about and I pray about, I wonder about, why is it that we're not as successful, perhaps especially Anabaptist churches, but churches all across America aren't that successful in evangelism? Why is it? If we give up our beliefs to try to get more people in the church, we're failing. We don't want that. But on the other hand, we do want strategy. And it has to be the sort of strategy that is spirit-led and that comes right from our beliefs. I'm going to circle back and talk about that in a minute. After I get through, I'm going to kind of fly through the list of these things fairly fast, and we're going to go back to what does it look like to change the way we think about discipleship in order to reach Americans when it flows from our views of Scripture and from our beliefs instead of going outside of our beliefs to try to win people. I'm going to come back to that. First of all, let's hit these other points. Still on fellowship. So the first one, unsuccessful discipleship. Why is it that we're doing so poorly at unbelievers coming and discovering God and being in the church? Second thing is loneliness. I see a lot of people, I hear from a lot of people who say, look, I'm in a church. In fact, I'm in a big church. And I have a lot of people around me. I know a lot of people. I kind of recognize a lot of faces, but I'm not really at home. I don't really feel like I'm in a community that cares about me. They don't even know what I did last week. And they don't really necessarily look like they care. And so loneliness should not be in the church if we're doing the fellowship thing. If we got fellowship as part of, you know, the apostles' doctrine and the fellowship, breaking of bread and prayers, if we have the fellowship part of that, we should not have loneliness. And if you think about what Christianity really is, loneliness doesn't make sense in light of that. Because we talk about it as a body. like all the parts are working together, and if one part isn't functioning, all of them are like, whoa, stop it all. There's a part that's not functioning correctly. Let's fix it. And obviously with people, it doesn't look like fixing in that sense. But we need to think in terms of the body, not in terms of like a group of people. But loneliness is an issue. And I'd be interested to hear from any of you who feel like loneliness isn't an issue in your church. I think there are churches where loneliness isn't an issue. I certainly do. I think it's something that every church is going to deal with in some way or another. And there are some people who just aren't open to having that sort of fellowship and back and forth in the church. And that's a problem too. But I'm asking, if we are church, if we're going to be the strategic church, what does it look like to really combat the problem of loneliness? Third thing, weak Christians. I feel like I've been in some time periods in my life, and certainly many people that that I've closely related with, I think we all have faced in some time periods of our life not growing. And we just feel like we're stuck. And we talk about not connecting with the Word, and prayer seems dead, and like I'm hitting a wall every time I try to connect with God. And in some sense, being a Christian, you run into some of those dry times in our life where we have to press in and ask God, what's wrong? I want to work through this and discover God in the middle of this dry season of my life. But what about when it's an epidemic? What about when it seems like everyone's kind of weak, and where it's not the standard that when you look at the teachings of Christ, you're coming there because you say, everything in my life is out before God, and if God wants to change anything in my life, it's all there. That's a strong Christian who doesn't have it all together, but he has the right attitude. What if we're not teaching that enough? Of Christianity looks like whole life discipleship, where God's message and the glory of God is the central theme of our life. And so when I'm looking at my hobbies, or when I'm looking at my vacations, or my lifestyle choices, or my work, whatever I'm looking at, the glory of God is my central goal. That is an exciting life. And I wonder sometimes if it's not really the standard, and it's not really what we're even trying for, or what we pretend like is the norm. I think a lot of times we pretend like the sort of weak Christianity of, like, not really, sorry, alarm. We pretend like the weak Christianity of, it's just okay if I haven't really connected with God for a while, and I'm just kind of trying to make it for a while without really hearing from God and without really loving his word. If that's the norm instead of the exception, that's a problem. But it's a problem that God wants to be fixed. And it's a problem that if we're going to be strategic church, then we're going to care about. And we're going to ask ourselves, what does it take to preach strong Christianity instead of being okay with weak Christianity? The fourth thing is sex addictions. And this has obviously become an epidemic as well of perhaps staggering proportions of people, of us, hooked on pornography, struggling with all sorts of sexual sin. And it's something where I think a weak church is the one that doesn't talk about it. But sometimes we feel like we want to be strong, so we don't want to talk about it because it's embarrassing. And it's, I'll give this example. Probably a couple of months ago, the Ravi Zacharias allegations came out, that Ravi Zacharias, famous Christian teacher, apologist, philosopher, had made unwanted sexual advances on women at a spa that he owned, that he had masturbated in front of them, that he had basically behaved very unseemly. And those allegations came out, and it was something I think that just sunk on my heart. Like, that again? Because those stories seem to be increasing, and a lot of Christian leaders are struggling with that, with sexual sins coming out. And this isn't something from the last 10 years, it might be something from the last 40 years. But it just seems like, in looking at that as a younger guy and thinking, man, we're the church that's coming on. I don't want that. I don't want that to be the story of the church, where God's name is getting pressed in the mud every day because people are talking about this and people are saying, look, he preached Christianity his life. He said that there's a judgment where God is going to punish all evildoers. And yet he lived that. Did he have the real thing? What is Christianity? That's the sort of thing that people are asking. And so, if we're going to be the strategic church, we need honesty, we need transparency, and we need the sort of fellowship where I know what you're dealing with and you know what I'm dealing with. And to where sins of any sort, including sexual sin, can be something that we talk about and we deal with in the church. It can't be something where it's all shushed. We won't talk about it until it comes out and the world despises God because of it. Strategic church looks like facing our issues head on through the power of God's Spirit and making changes to be strategic. All right, fourth one on fellowship. Lack of strong leadership. I know many strong leaders in my life, including the elders here in this congregation, that are incredible. I feel like I've been very blessed to have the support and the teaching and the direction of strong leaders who I appreciate and have grown so much through being under them. So this is not a reflection on my church. But I ask the question, we want to have strong leadership that's not just elders, it's not just at the top, but we want to have strong leadership where each person's taking responsibility for their actions. There needs to be leaders at the top. I firmly believe in church authority. I think it's a wonderful thing, and it's what God designed. We also need leadership throughout all areas of the Christian life and through all areas of the church. So what do we do to raise up leadership within the church to be strong, to carry the gospel? And so if we're looking at church and we're not seeing leaders raised up and enabled and given roles to be able to lead out effectively, we need to ask ourselves, so why is it? Are there people not ready? Are there people unable to? Are there people who don't want to lead? Are leadership opportunities not being given? Are we not training leaders so that they're ready when the time comes? I think those are all pertinent questions that we should be asking. We need strong leadership to be the strategic church of tomorrow. And through God's Spirit, church can, and I believe the church will be more a church raising up strong leaders so that the gospel can be spread and so that the church is strong on every level. All right, let's turn from fellowship issues to thinking issues. First one on thinking issues is the sacred secular division, and I'm going to touch on this really briefly because I already nailed it a little bit. Sacred secular division is this idea that I have my area of life where there's like Christ's commands, like don't hate your brother, like the Sermon on the Mount, all the things that Christ says you should do, and then you have things in the epistles. You gotta love your enemies. All of those commands, whether they came from Paul or whether they came directly through Christ, all of these commands of God, there's like the area of my life that's touched by those commands where it's like, I need to do what God says. And then there's the area of life where I kind of do my own thing, and I should be a good person in all of life, but there are areas of my life that aren't really touched by my Christianity, and so I have to figure out life on my own. I think that this actually touches us maybe more than we think, because I may have parodied that view a little bit too much, but I think we all do that sometimes, where it's like, so when it comes to my hobbies, what does that look like? Are there Christian hobbies? Like, does God say that this is wrong? We start asking those questions of like, I want to get this right. Like, what does God say I must do? I want to suggest that that's the wrong way of looking at life. And the Christian way of looking at life is when Paul says, whatever I do it with all my heart as to the Lord and not to man. And when he says, whatever you do in word, whatever you do in word or in action, indeed, or action, do everything to the glory of God. It's that sort of whole life spirituality that defines us as believers. You know what? That is incredibly attractive. When you meet someone who their entire life, all that they do just flows right back into the fact that they love God. It's not that they have a whole system of rules and they're like, yeah, I can point the chapter and verse where that shows that I must do this. But then when it comes to this, God just doesn't really say anything about it, so I'm on my own. That's not very attractive. When you meet somebody who says everything flows back into the fact that I love God and the fact that I love my neighbor. And so whether it's what I'm doing when I am in work or in my hobbies or whatever, it's all because of the fact that I love God. And so when we're talking about reaching out to others, relational discipleship, having that division between sacred and secular and between what God says I have to do and what I can try to figure out on my own, not supposed to be there. When we have that division, that'll stop us from evangelism. But when we have the sort of discipleship that flows from everything in my life is all under God, that's when we start making progress in all areas of life because it's distinctly Christian. Number two, in thinking issues. I think we're unprepared for assaults on our beliefs. I do see, and this is very encouraging, I see a lot of young people who are more and more, like myself, more and more thinking in terms of beliefs and saying, what's true and what's false? I need to figure this out. And not in a godless way, but in the sort of way where you say, I want to know God and I want to know what God says and I want to discover everything about Christianity and about this lifestyle that Christ lived. When we're not prepared to defend our beliefs in the public square and defend our beliefs when unbelievers ask us about them, we're not prepared to do discipleship and we're not thinking well. And so on that, I want to suggest that we take a closer look at our beliefs, but we do it intentionally. I don't want you to just say, well, I need to figure out all my beliefs, so let me start making a Google Doc and write down all my beliefs and try to find Bible verses for them, because that sounds really boring. What I want you to do, and I don't think it would even be that helpful, what I want you to do, to think about doing, is I want you to think about, when it comes to the resurrection, how does that impact all areas of my life? When it comes to the cross, how does that impact all areas of my life? The central things of what you believe can impact every area of your life if you think that way. And so as Christians, let's think, and as young people, for the strategic church of tomorrow, let's start thinking in terms of what do our beliefs impact? How do they impact our life? And man, when somebody asks me what I believe, I'm not just gonna say, hey, here's a Bible verse for you to look at. I'm going to say, look, here's the resurrection, and here's how it changed my entire life. Last year, I had a little note card that I put on my desk that said, if the resurrection is true, how does it change how I live today? Incredibly helpful. Because it's supposed to change everything. And Paul says, look, if the resurrection is not true, we're the most miserable people on earth. That's what he says. The resurrection is supposed to be something so integral to the Christian faith that knowing it and knowing what it means should make you get up out of bed and enjoy life, and it can. And so allow the resurrection to be something that's impactful in your life by thinking about it and not thinking about it in a cold, dead way, but asking yourself, if the resurrection is true, how would it change the way I live, the way I relate to my parents, the way I relate to my boss? How would it change that decision that I make about my money? It can be an exciting journey of realizing how your beliefs affect your life if you're willing to make that step. The third point on thinking issues, fear of reason. This is something where I've realized myself and many others included, tend to look at reason as something dangerous, perhaps anti-spirit. Like, we want to be spirit-led, and reason just seems like it kind of takes away from living in the spirit. Or reason can look like something where it's proud, and it's something that you do because you want to beat someone up intellectually. And I'll be honest, there are times when I wanted to beat someone up intellectually, and where I thought in terms of that. That's reason that's used wrongly. That's not a problem with reason, it's a problem with our pride. And so with reason, if we have a fear of reason, when we're having discussions about politics or education or theology or anything else, if we're afraid of reason, it damages the way we think in every category, because we're unwilling to really take our beliefs seriously, and we're unwilling to really defend them honestly. Let me give you a couple examples. Just for reference, how many of you are familiar with the straw man fallacy? Could you raise your hand? Okay, maybe a quarter. A straw man fallacy is when you take the opponent's argument and you try to make it look as dumb as possible so that you can refute it. Now, why is this wrong? It's wrong because it's dishonest. So what reason comes down to, I'm using this as one example of reason, because I want to show how reasoning well is actually very, very Christian. When people use the straw man fallacy, somebody gives an argument for what they believe, and you say, "That's so dumb. Let me show you how that's dumb." And then you start explaining, saying their argument back to them and trying to show how dumb it is, but you're actually twisting their argument so that you make it look as dumb as possible. You're not really giving their argument a fair trial. That is what straw man fallacy is. It comes from the idea of boxing, I believe, when if you want to take on an opponent, instead of getting the real guy out there to trade blows with, you set up a straw man that looks like him, and they just knock the straw man over. And that's, you know, it's supposed to be like a really dumb illustration of what happens when you want to win an argument, but you're doing it dishonestly. So what we need to do instead of using the straw man fallacy of trying to destroy something that's not really the opponent's argument, we need to honestly take a look at it. And when we disagree, we need to take the other person's basic ideas seriously. We need to respond to those ideas, not to the straw man of them. And we need to honor them by taking their beliefs seriously. Other fallacies are the red herring fallacy, when you try to distract from the argument when you realize you're losing, which is incredibly easy to do if you feel like you're losing an argument. You try to change the subject, or you go on to something else where you feel like you can win better. The honest thing to do is to admit that you're wrong. Admit that you didn't win that side of the argument. And listen to what the other person is saying. That's honest reasoning. Why is that important in the church? And why is that important for the strategic church? Because we're going to have a whole lot of conversations with unbelievers now, much less so than believers, because unbelievers are what are predominantly in our culture just now, by far. And we need to be honest about those conversations, and within the church, we need to be honest about the conversations about our beliefs. When we're with someone we disagree, we need to take what they say seriously, because we are honest truth seekers. That's what Christians are. And so whether it's a straw man fallacy or the red herring fallacy or any of the other many fallacies, those things are good to know, and those things are really good to value, to knowing reason, knowing how to effectively share your beliefs and take the other person's beliefs seriously and respond to them, will make your conversations about life and any other category so much more effective and so much more helpful. So don't have fear of reason. It actually comes from the character of God as honest and as non-contradictory, and we need reason in the church, but only reason that's humble and reason that's under God. We're going to have a discussion here on, I believe, Thursday afternoon between Drew and James, Drew Barnard and James Charles. I'll be moderating that. And that discussion, I think, is going to be very interesting. It's going to be on the topic of evangelism and dealing with the culture around us. What are choices that we need to make to be more effective? And what I would like that discussion to be is to be something of a model of here's what Christians look like when they're taking each other's arguments seriously, when they're having respectful dialogue but disagreeing strongly. I don't know what things Drew and James will disagree on. We're going to kind of figure that out as we go, which will be great. But we want to have just a deep and helpful conversation that is Christian in every sense. Taking reason seriously and being humble and coming about that well. So I hope you're all there for that. I'm looking forward to that. The fourth point on thinking, poor processing of controversy. I'll just touch on this briefly because that flows into the last question. When we don't know how to deal with controversy in the church, when two people that we agree with, love, think that they're great Christians, disagree, when those two people disagree, how do we deal with that? How do we deal with it when someone that I know deeply disagrees with something I believe in, and yet I know that they're a believer and that they're following God? How we have those conversations determines how many church splits we have. It determines how much love we see in the church. Those are huge things. We need to process controversy well. And again, thinking must be personal. It cannot be a cold and dead, like I just need to learn bigger words and learn how to bash opponents more. It can't look like that. It must look personal. And I want to really discover what you're saying. I want to know you as an individual. And so it's not just I'm taking on your beliefs to try to convince you of something. It should be I want to know you as a person. And so I take your beliefs seriously and I think about the gospel and about what my beliefs are because I want to discover truth with you. So once again, we're people of the owner's manual. So when it comes to church, what we're asking is not, we're not entirely in the dark. We're not just asking what new tricks shall we try. We're asking how do we get back to the roadmap? Where we've been wrong, where things are not going well, and we talked about weak Christians and loneliness and sex addictions within the church and fear of reason and all of these things. When we're looking at those, we need to come back and ask ourselves, what's the model? The apostles' doctrine, the fellowship, the prayers, the breaking of bread. And we need to get back to that. The apostles' doctrine is thinking better. The prayer, the fellowship, and the breaking of bread is the fellowship together. So I want to ask you to do two things. As you're looking forward to 2021, I mean, as we're in 2021, looking forward to the rest of it and beyond, commit to relational discipleship. Don't be scared of commitment. Desire fellowship because it's what makes or breaks our lives. Desire to really know people around you, the people in your church. Make church something that's not just something you do, but really get to know the people around you. You can't get to know your entire church if your entire church is hundreds of people, and that's okay. But get to know the people right around you and press in to know them relationally and to be discipled together. Number one, commit to relational discipleship. Number two, resolve to think. And that thinking cannot be, let me say it one more time, cannot be cold and dead, but it must be relational. Our thinking must be in terms of God, in terms of loving God, and in terms of loving each other. We have to work through our beliefs. We have to ask ourselves, look, how do we work through the resurrection and the death of Christ and the idea of kingdom, which is huge? How do we work through those central ideas of the Christian faith and apply it to our lives in every way? How do we discover the joy, the love, the power of God in every area of life? But we need to ask those questions together and under God. So we need to have relational discipleship and we need to think. A couple more things on the point of thinking here. We're the generation that doesn't want to act unless we're convinced. If we don't believe that something is from the Bible, we're not going to do it. If we believe that there's church rules, let's say, that don't come from Scripture, or we don't agree with the beliefs, we don't want to do it. There's danger to that. There's also, I think, a good sense in which our generation is realizing we have to be committed to our beliefs. We have to be able to defend them. We can't just say, this is what our church said. We can't just say, this is what I must do. We have to be the sorts of Christians that give our faith on the level of, this has changed my life, and I hope it does yours as well, because it's that good. And so, we're the generation that won't act unless we're convinced. So, Fight to become convinced of what is true. Don't just have the attitude that says, I'm not going to act unless I'm convinced, and then let it go and not really fight to know the truth and to let it change you. Don't settle for cheap skepticism. There's a skepticism that says, you know, I don't really know what's true and what's false, and I don't really care. That's not Christian. Christianity says beliefs matter because God gave us truth and he was truth. So beliefs matter. And yet, and so because beliefs matter, we're not just going to be okay with skepticism. We need to ask the questions and we need to find the answers. We're never going to find all the answers because that's part of what it means to be finite. What we can do is we can take our beliefs seriously. We can enjoy the process of discovering truth, discovering our beliefs in the fellowship of each other, and we can value our beliefs together. Another thing, we tend to be afraid of a fake spirituality. That's good. The sort of fake spirituality where it's put on and I'm doing this or that, you know, I'm whatever it is, all of those Christian symbols and stuff, will say, like raising our hands in worship, I don't want to do that unless it's for real. That's good. Be for real. Or other things. We need to be authentic, but let it be an authentic spirituality that flows from your beliefs. Don't put anything on, but take your beliefs seriously so that your beliefs begin to influence your actions in every area. Let your beliefs impact your lifestyle in every way. Another thing on the idea of authentic spirituality, be candid about your faults and about your victories. Be candid when stuff goes terribly wrong, and be frank about when God has worked through you and given you victory in something. We're a lot more okay with sharing our failures because that's kind of cool in a sense. Like, I think it is to say, I had a huge failure. It's a lot more cool to say I'm struggling deeply with resentment towards my parents than it is to say God has given me victory in allowing me to live in a good relationship with my parents. That sounds awkward. And we're a lot more okay with saying I'm really failing than I'm really succeeding. We can't do that. We have to be authentic in every area. And so not in pride, but in humility, we need to be okay with saying we're Christians. And Christians have failures, and God's Spirit works through Christians, and they are successful in the Christian life because God works through them. I want to imagine something together. I want you to imagine with me a church that is full of people who used to be unbelievers, but they desire God. They want to know about what we believe. They're in the church, unbelievers wanting to know what we believe, but then those who are in the church being discipled and wanting to discover more of God. A church that is not full of members who are lonely, not full of members who are struggling forever with sex addictions that they can't break, not full of Christians who don't care for reason, but full of Christians who are enabled, who take their beliefs seriously and understand how their beliefs affect every area of their life. I want you to imagine a church that strategically works on those areas in which we're poor. And in relational discipleship, in fellowship, and then in thinking better about our beliefs, and in thinking together. A church that works on those two categories and lets the truth of Christianity and everything that the church was, strong in the apostles' doctrine, strong on the breaking of bread and fellowship and the prayers. Imagine a church that's strong on those things and that is prepared, like Kolakovich's church, where they had thousands of resistance cells that kept the church alive and kept it one of the strongest churches in all of Eastern Europe. What does strategic church look like for us right now? How do we work on those core areas? And how do we as youth start right where we're at and start making a difference towards each of those things. This book is Live Not by Lies. I took the story of Kolakovich from it. And it's a powerful book. It's written by an Eastern Orthodox man. I don't agree with everything in it, but Rod Dreher, Live Not by Lies, is a fantastic book about what it looks like for the church to become strong against totalitarianism and an authoritarian ideology in Marxism and in the many other anti-Christian doctrines. How do we become strong against those things? How do we live as the church? We have a couple of minutes left here, and I'd like to give you a minute or two to write down a couple things. Something that, in the many things we discussed here, what does it look like for me to change one thing to be more strategic in a humble way, in a God-centered way, to be more strategic about the way I do church? A couple of minutes of that, and then I'll turn it back to you, Tim.
Thank you for listening. We hope this message has blessed you. If you would like additional messages, please visit our website at ccfsermons.org. Call us at 855-55-CHARITY or write to us at Charity Christian Fellowship, 59 South Groffdale Road, Leola, PA, 17540. This ministry is supported by your donations. May Jesus Christ be Lord of all.